Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Imagine a system in which all Americans would be covered for health care all the time, cradle to grave, in any corner of the country, and the bill for medical services would be paid not out of your pocket or by an HMO, but by a government health insurance plan, a kind of Medicare for all. Nearly 8,000 American doctors have signed on in support of a radical new national health insurance proposal outlined in tomorrow's issue of the Journal of American Medical Association. Sweeping reform, they say, is the only way to address a crisis of mismanaged private health insurance in the growing ranks of the uninsured. But critics of universal single-payer health care, and there are many, are still vocally opposed, skeptical that the government can alone or should alone be in the business of providing universal, comprehensive health care coverage. So is radical reform through the creation of a national health insurance plan the answer for 41 million uninsured Americans? Would it be better for you? And whatever the crisis, can you imagine government-run national health insurance ever prevailing in America? Should it? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from East Chatham, New York, is Dr. David Himmelstein, Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard University and co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. He is a lead author of the proposal for a single-payer national health insurance program outlined in the August 13th issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. Good evening and welcome, David Himmelstein.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Also with me in the studio tonight is Dr. Marcia Angel, senior lecturer at Harvard Medical School and former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. Good evening and welcome.
Good evening.
Marcia Angel. Thanks
Good
for
to be here.
Thanks for being with us. David Himmelstein, to you first. It seems like a decade since we've had big, serious talk about major national health care reform, and now you and several thousand doctors are plunging in saying we've got to talk about it and we've got to have it now, and nothing will do but to basically, as I read your proposal, shut down the whole private system we've got out there and replace it with a government-administered system. Why the call for this dramatic step? Why now?
Well, our healthcare system is failing. Millions of people have no insurance, and millions more have coverage only in name, coverage that's so inadequate that if they were seriously ill, they'd be ruined by that illness. And the system is failing for patients, failing for doctors, failing for nurses, failing for everyone. And it's time that we admit that our private health insurance companies do nothing useful in the system at present and aren't doing the job. We can't afford them. They take tens of billions of dollars in premiums that they don't actually pay out in benefits. We need that money to do the job for the American people. And we know that national health insurance can achieve universal coverage, and there's no other system that can.
But we are told repeatedly that America has the best health care in the world, and that one of the reasons for that is that it's in private hands. You know the kind of criticism that's leveled against government-run health care systems. Americans have been told for years that you go that way and you're going to be sitting in a dingy waiting room somewhere for service that may or may not ever come.
Spend twice as much as any other country on health care, and yet we get surprisingly little. We have higher death rates than many other countries. We have higher infant mortality rates than, I think, 23 other nations at this point. And even our surgical mortality rates, our outcomes for many procedures, are worse than other nations to which we'd compare ourselves. So while our insurance companies have spent many millions of dollars to try and convince Americans that we have the best possible system, in fact, the data doesn't show it. We ought to have the best system because we spend so much. And with a properly organized system and what we now spend, we could have the best care, but we don't at present.
So what exactly are you and the doctors who have signed on here proposing?
Basically, an expanded and improved Medicare program that would cover every American for all medically necessary medical care, and including prescription drugs, and replace the private insurance industry with a government insurance program. It would still leave most doctors in private practice and most hospitals run privately as private organizations, but the bills would be paid out of a government tax-funded fund.
It sounds incredibly expensive. Can the country afford such a change?
In fact, we can't afford not to. We're spending so much now on the profits and the paperwork of our private insurance companies and the entrepreneurs who are feeding at the trough of medicine that hundreds of billions are wasted each year on useless things that do no good for any patient. And that's the money we need to provide care. Just to give you an example, our Medicare program runs for 3.6% of total costs for its overhead.
Mm-hmm.
And the average private insurance program charges 12% overhead in this country. That's tens of billions of dollars, and we need that money to provide care.
But private industry is supposed to bring efficiency. Where do you see the flaws in the current privately insured healthcare system? Why is it expensive?
Well, private industry is alleged to bring efficiency, but in healthcare it doesn't. In fact, our private businesses compete not to provide high-quality care, but to avoid expensive, money-losing patients, and more and more to defraud the insurance firms and the government of money. So our for-profit hospitals have defrauded Medicare of hundreds of millions of dollars by charging for procedures that patients didn't need and other schemes. Our insurance companies spend hugely on avoiding sick patients who are money losers for them. And in fact, the way you make a profit in our healthcare system as a business is to avoid expensive patients who are often the ones who need the care most.
Marcia Angel, help put this in perspective for us. First of all, we read here in the Journal of the American Medical Association, we've got to have this. The house is burning down. There's no time to waste. We've got to have it right now. And then, the very instant that this thing is made public, I'm reading here the statement from the American Medical Association itself saying, we do not endorse this solution. This is not the way to go. We should stick with many elements of the private insurance system that we've had for a long time. We've got nearly 8,000 doctors signing on to this, and we can hear David Himmelstein's argument loud and clear, yet there are, 800,000 or so doctors in this country, and the AMA is saying, no, this is not the way to go. What's the context? Is this, we see this as being boldly put forward in the journal, and yet we know what the history is. We remember what happened with Bill Clinton's effort. Is there a context in which this can possibly fly? Has something changed? Who is it that's speaking up here for this change?
Something has changed. The inherent flaws in our market-based system were to some extent masked during the 1990s, during the economic boom of the 1990s. But now, with the softening of the economy, all of these problems have become all too apparent. What we're seeing is health insurance premiums now rising at double-digit rates. Employers are finding they can't afford it, and so what they're doing is capping their contributions to workers' health insurance and leaving the workers themselves to bear the inflation, which they can't do.
Or to accept less thorough coverage.
Exactly. And so the coverage is shrinking. And then as unemployment rises, a lot of people are losing what limited coverage they had. Employers don't feel they have to offer good health benefits as unemployment rises, whereas in the late 90s they did.
To
be competitive, exactly right. And Medicaid, the states are in great trouble now, so Medicaid will be shrunk. We are seeing a crisis, and with all due respect to the AMA, the house is on fire.
But David Himmelstein mentioned that many people may not understand how thin their coverage actually is. They may
That's
have
right.
a health insurance policy that they rely on, but it may not actually be there for them.
That's
give
correct.
Us some examples of that. I'm not sure many people really understand that. You check a box at work if you're lucky enough to have a job and insurance offered with it that says, here's what I'll take for coverage. But what kind of things can lead to the financial ruin that David Himmelstein referred to?
Well, employers can make their own policy with the HMOs who offer them the best premiums, and that policy can be quite limited. And a worker might not know that until he comes down with a disease that's precisely the disease that is not covered.
Mm-hmm.
And there's certain things like prescription drugs that are being covered less and less. So the whole benefit package is shrinking. And you say people might not know it, but they know a lot about it. They know now that when they go to their doctors are very rushed because the HMOs are demanding that they see patients faster and faster. They know that they find it harder to get reimbursement for what they pay. They're hassled. Doctors are hassled. They pay increasing deductibles and co-payments. So I think the public knows pretty well that the system is in trouble.
David Himmelstein. The AMA comes out in response to the article today, the call for national health insurance, and says, this is from the president of the AMA, a solution to the problem of the uninsured is desperately needed, but a single-payer health care system, that's what you're proposing, is not the answer. The AMA advocates a solution to the uninsured crisis that builds on the strengths of our current system. By implementing a single-payer system, the U.S. would be trading one problem for a whole set of others. If this is such a great idea, why isn't the AMA supporting it?
Well, the AMA is a dying organization. 20 years ago, 60% of American doctors belonged to it. Now, only about 25% of American doctors belong to it, and their membership is shrinking every day. And this is an example of why. They've been saying basically the same thing for the last 50 years, and over that time, we've had no progress towards universal coverage. In fact, we have more people uninsured today than at any time since Medicare and Medicaid were passed back in the mid-1960s.
But take us into the interests at play here. Why would the AMA, whatever percentage of doctors it has as its membership, why would it oppose national health insurance?
Well, I think they represent a small faction of the highest income doctors who, by and large, are more worried about their incomes and their own self-interest than about their patients or about the medical profession and its position in society broadly.
Would doctors' incomes fall under a national health insurance program?
We think that on average, most doctors' incomes would stay roughly where they are today, but the most entrepreneurial doctors who are making a killing today probably would see a fall in their income.
And why is that? Because what they could charge would be controlled by the government, and so they just couldn't rack up the same incomes?
That's right, and because some of the outlandish incomes that are now being made, I mean, there are some doctors making in the millions, would just not be possible under any reasonable program.
But would Americans have access to the same sophistication of care, the same technology, the same, super surgeons under a national health insurance program as they do when they're lucky enough to have access to those under privately insured coverage?
Well, the same doctors and nurses would be employed and operating in the system after it became national health insurance as before. So, in fact, we think, yes, over the long term, at this point, medical schools are having more and more trouble attracting top applicants because medicine is becoming a less and less desirable profession. As the grumbling in our profession increases, you know, the oaths one hears in doctors' offices now are not mostly Hippocratic. They're swearing about the system we work in.
And what's the major complaint?
The complaint is that we're being forced to pay attention to paperwork and business and not to our patients.
So a national health insurance policy would mean doctors don't have to worry about that. But what about the kind of stereotypical view that we've had of that it just doesn't deliver the goods the way private insurance, privately insured health coverage does?
Well, for what we're now spending, we could have the best health care system by far in the world. We spend roughly twice what Canada does, and yet Canada has lower death rates than we do. We ought to be able to do much better than Canada, in fact, and we ought to not only be able to cover everyone, but have the high technology medicine that we need and the prescription drugs that we need. In some instances, we ought to eliminate some of what we're doing. So we're doing, for instance, a lot of unnecessary heart surgery. Just a case came to light in California where a hospital owned by one of the for-profit firms was doing hundreds of clearly unnecessary open-heart surgical procedures. That kind of high-tech medicine we don't need, and we ought to eliminate. But for what is useful to patients, we ought to be able to do it.
Dr. David Himmelstein, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
David Himmelstein is Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard University and co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. Marcia Angel, stand by. There's a lot more to talk about here. We're looking at a bold call today from doctors for radical reform of the American healthcare system, an end to private health insurance, and a government takeover of American healthcare. What do you think? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight about a bold call today from American doctors, several thousand of them anyway, for radical reform of the American healthcare system, a major article coming out in tomorrow's Journal of the American Medical Association calls for basically an end to private health insurance in the United States, for the government to take over the insuring of all Americans, cradle to grave, a kind of lifelong Medicare program that would end the problem of uninsured Americans and underinsured Americans. What do you think? Is it time for a radical reshaping of American health care? Is national health insurance the only way to get all America covered? And are you among the uninsured? If you are insured, have you felt your coverage getting thinner, more expensive, less complete? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by Marcia Angel. She's senior lecturer at the Harvard Medical School and former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. And now from Gaithersburg, Maryland, by Joseph Antos, former assistant director for health and human resources in the Congressional Budget Office from 1995 to 2001, and a scholar in healthcare and retirement policy at the American Enterprise Institute. Good evening and welcome, Joseph Antos.
Hi. This proposal is a proposal whose time has not yet come in this country. It's been raised several times over the past decade or so, but I think we're exactly where we have been every other time national health reform has entered the political scene. People just aren't ready for it.
And we'll talk about why that's the case, but is that a good thing or a bad thing, Joseph Antos? Would the United States be better off if politically it was prepared to adopt national health insurance? Do you favor it, whatever the politics may be?
I don't favor this proposal for a couple of reasons. The biggest concern that I think we should all have is whether the Medicare program, and this is basically the Medicare program expanded to everybody, whether the Medicare program really works now. And if you talk to physicians, if you talk to most physicians, they will tell you that it is just as unpleasant, in fact, even more unpleasant, to be interrogated by an agent of the Medicare program who questions their billings, who has the legal authority to hold up their payments, can turn their practices upside down, looking for evidence of wrongdoing, I'm sorry if they're wrong. Physicians, I think, would not support this proposal, and if physicians wouldn't support it, and I'm talking about the physicians who've had the experience, which is the majority of physicians in this country.
So you're saying physicians today get grilled by private health insurance operators. They get grilled by Medicare as well. And on balance, in your view, they'd rather deal with the private health insurers that they know rather than have the whole thing go public.
No, that's not quite what I said.
All right.
I said that this proposal promises a kind of Eden as far as paperwork and administrative cost and so on is concerned. All I'm pointing out is that the hassle factor in the Medicare program is very, very high. So we'll just trade the evil health plan executive for the benevolent bureaucrat. Well, I don't think it's going to work out that way.
But if it's evil either way, and we'll have Marcia Angel weigh in on that, but saying that it is, that there'll always be bureaucrats overseeing, whether private or public, of one kind or another, wouldn't it be better to have all Americans covered rather than, doctors have hassles now and 40-plus million Americans have no coverage?
Sure. It would be better if we found a way to make it possible for people, for everybody to get health insurance, appropriate health insurance. But we have to be careful about this. We have to be careful about, again, this view that, you know, some learned board will decide what sorts of new technologies and what sorts of new treatments will cover. Let me say that this is not a theoretical concern. A few weeks ago, the Medicare program had an opportunity to cover implantable defibrillators for people with serious heart conditions. They convened an expert panel. The expert panel made a recommendation, and the Medicare program decided not to follow the recommendation of the expert panel, and instead covered this technology, this life-saving technology, for a small subset of the patients that the experts said should be covered. This is the concern, and you can't fire your health plan if there's only the government plan.
If it's the government. Joseph Antos, stand by. Marcia Angel, there's a lot to pick up on here.
Yes.
Let's leave the politics to the side for just another moment, but what about this concern that if you had national health insurance, you had a kind of national Medicare for everybody, now suddenly what treatments that are available are not available are in the hands of bureaucrats who will not be subject to market pressures. They are more likely to be perhaps conservative, and Americans end up losing cutting-edge medicine, cutting-edge coverage that they feel that if they're lucky, they'll be entitled to or have access to now that the whole thing gets kind of mediocritized if it becomes government-run. What do you say to that?
Well, let me start by saying that, as was pointed out, we put twice as much into our health care system now as the other advanced countries, all of which have single-payer systems.
And so we spend twice as much.
We spend twice as much. So if we were to put the amount of money we now spend, $1.6 trillion, into a single-payer system, there would be no limitations whatsoever on the treatment.
Well, Medicare is there right now, and we just heard some limitations described, but those would go away magically or because the resources would be so great?
No, let me just say, in terms of Medicare denying, and I don't know this particular example, so I haven't looked at that.
All right.
But in terms of Medicare denying any services, the same thing could happen with private insurers.
And does happen.
And does happen, and for slightly different reasons. It happens in order to make a profit for the investors who own these companies. The single-payer system, and also let me say that Medicare is not perfect. It does need some reform. But it does provide a package of benefits to everyone over the age of 65 who qualifies that cannot be taken away, nor can it be reduced. It's not like the private system for people under 65 where you can lose it overnight, you lose your job, you've lost your insurance.
Or get a contract renegotiated and off it goes.
Exactly. Or it's also not a defined contribution, as your employer will give you when he caps his contribution towards your insurance. It's a defined benefit. All of those benefits are there forever.
And under this proposal would be for all Americans. Marcia
Angel. Let me finish one point, the final point. The data certainly contradict Mr. Antos. There have been surveys of people in the private system and in the Medicare system. Medicare is far more popular,
I want to open the door just a little wider for one moment and invite in David Satcher, joining us from Atlanta, Georgia tonight. He's former U.S. Surgeon General from 1998 to 2002, now director of the National Center for Primary Care at Morehouse School of Medicine. Good evening and welcome, David Satcher.
Good evening, Tom. I'm delighted to be with you.
Thanks for being with us. You have no doubt seen the big JAMA article that's come out, the big call for national health insurance. Is this quixotic, David Satcher? Is there I don't know, a snowball's chance in a bad hospital of this passing? Do American politics have room for a single-payer, universal coverage, national health insurance, or is this just, as Joseph Antos suggests, not going to happen?
Well, I would certainly not take the position that it's not going to happen. I think we are facing a situation in healthcare in this country, perhaps that we've never faced before, where virtually all sectors are unhappy. I mean, it's not just the patients and the payers, doctors. I've never seen so many doctors unhappy with the healthcare system as we see today. I've spent a lot of my career encouraging young people to go practice in underserved communities. And it's really something now when they get there and whenever there's a budget issue and they cut back on Medicaid and they suffer all kinds of setbacks because of changes they cannot predict. But, you know, people are unhappy with managed care programs. So a lot of disgust about health care in this country. At the same time as we're paying, as you've heard, I'm sure, before I came on, mm-hmm. we're paying much more than anybody else in terms of absolute amount, in terms of per capita, in terms of gross national product. I mentioned this morning that the World Health Organization released a report in 2000 on health system efficiency. And even though they acknowledged the magnitude of our expenditures, they also pointed out that they would rank us number 37 among the nations in terms of health system efficiency. Based on the fact, number one, that there's so many people left out of our system, even then there were over 40 million people uninsured, and certainly that many, if not more, underinsured.
But David Setcher, how then do you interpret American politics or American culture that the United States is the only developed nation not to have national health insurance? What is it about our politics or our culture or our presumptions that has prevented the U.S. from going down this path to date? And do you really think that's going to change now or in the foreseeable future?
Well, you know, I've seen a lot of change in my life. That's the first thing. I mean, obviously, unfortunately, we have treated health as a commodity to be traded in the marketplace to the highest bidder. I don't think we can go on that way, and I think most people are beginning to realize that we can't go on that way. We can't go on leaving out so many millions of people out of the system. But it's not just those who are left out. I think the people who are in the system are also not getting the best care. We spend over 90% of our health budget treating diseases and their complications, many of which could have been prevented in the first place. In our system, there is no incentive for health promotion and disease prevention. In fact, we spend less than 2% of our health budget on population-based prevention. I think all of that can change with the national health plan, where everybody is covered, and where also it's managed in such a way as to maximize health, not just treat disease.
David Setcher, Joseph Antos, Marcia Angel, stand by. A lot of callers want to join us, and I'd like to turn to them. Robert's calling from Boston. Hello, Robert. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I've been a major proponent of this program for probably 15 or 20 years, and there are just a couple of points that I'd like to bring out.
Are you in the medical industry, Robert?
Yes, I am. I'm a physician. Correct. I've written about this, as a matter of fact, and know a number of the callers. I think that we really need for people to understand the degree to which the profit sector is really draining the healthcare resources. If you look at what the overhead is for Medicare, my understanding is that it's somewhere about 3%, 3 to 5%.
Yes.
That is to say, that's the percentage of the dollar that is spent on the overhead, and the rest goes to the delivery of health care.
That percentage on administrative the
overhead.
Program.
If mm-hmm. you look yes. on the other hand at what many of the HMOs call their medical loss ratio, we are talking anywhere from 15 to 20%. We are talking about a variety of CEOs who are making millions of dollars. If we could take that money and redirect it into the actual delivery of services, we would be a lot better off. The other point that I think we need to really talk about is that it is obvious to any thinking person that this is the rational way, and you have pushed everybody to say, why isn't this happening in this country? And I find all the time people have this fear of socialized medicine. It's almost like communism. It's almost sort of felt to be antithetical to the American way.
So what do you say to that fear, Robert, as a physician, you looking a patient in the eye who's also a citizen and a voter?
I say to them, I can work every time I say directly to my patients, listen, would you prefer to have free choice of your doctor? Would you prefer to have your services covered? If that's what socialized medicine means, you're thinking about it in the wrong way. We've got to mobilize the public. The final thing I want to say, and then I'll I'll be quiet, is that I think that what may really turn the corner here is getting corporate America to join this. Believe it or not, there are cars being made in Canada because we can't afford to do them here because of the premiums of health insurance. I think when corporate America, when the corporate CEOs cry uncle, when their health insurance premiums are 25% to 30% of their gross revenue, there may be some chance for change.
That is an interesting point. Thanks for calling, Robert. Joseph Antos, let me put that to you, and I guess on a couple of fronts. First of all, the notion that the politics might be changing because corporations are carrying such a huge burden right now. And secondly, for Americans generally, a lot of Americans have felt the chill wind of losing health insurance or fearing they might lose it with the loss of a job. Is it possible that the national politics around this issue might be changing?
Well, of course, I'm not actually a politician, but professional politicians don't seem to think that. The Democratic Party has 9 candidates for president, and only Dennis Kucinich supports this dramatic a proposal. He supports a single-payer system. Every one of the other candidates support, I think you'd call it, incremental change.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that professional politicians in the party that is most likely to possibly support this idea have almost without exception said, no, this is too much for us today, and it's too much for us over the next, over the foreseeable future. We're not going to stake, our election on this particularly radical idea. So I really don't see it as something that people are going to rise up with one voice and say, let's change everything.
David Satcher, let me put the same question to you. Do you see a shift in national politics? Joseph Antos points out, and he's quite right, only Dennis Kucinich is proposing something like this, even in the Democratic camp. In the Republican camp, forget about it. Does that mean it's simply not going to happen?
Well, I think something happened today and certainly tomorrow when JAMA comes out that's never happened before, and that is to have this number of physicians getting together and asking for change of this magnitude. So I think, and that's just a part of it. I mean, there are many more physicians out there who would certainly sign on to such a plan because of the level of frustration in the healthcare system. So I think already there are major changes taking place, and I don't think there's any limit to how far these changes can go. Now, I don't know how soon, but I think as people hear more about this proposal and understand it and understand the implications for their lives and their families, they understand what it means when a person works all of his or her life and accumulates, buys a home, and then suffers one major illness and loses all of that. There are many families in this country who are experiencing that every day. Or a person in the family has a mental illness, and all of a sudden you find yourself facing poverty, losing your home or whatever. That's the situation we're facing, not just poor people who are struggling. And I don't know how much people have thought about this, but I think this proposal will demand people to really think about what's happening to us.
So maybe it's coming back into the middle of the national conversation. Marcia Angel, Joseph Antos, former Surgeon General David Satcher, please stand by. We'll be right back. We're talking about a bold call today from doctors for radical reform of the American health care system, an end to private health insurance, and a government takeover of American health care. Does it have a chance? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a bold call today from doctors around the country for radical reform of the American healthcare system. A big article coming out tomorrow in the Journal of the American Medical Association, backed by 8,000 doctors saying this system is falling apart, it's not working, and the only way to go is the way that every other developed country in the world has gone, to develop a national health insurance. That is not private. It means the end, it would mean the end of HMOs, the end of private health insurance, everybody signing on or being signed on automatically to government coverage, a kind of Medicare for all. What do you think? Does universal health insurance, universal health care of that stripe, single payer, have a chance, any chance of winning politically in America? And can you imagine the government putting all health insurers and HMOs out of business? Why is America the only developed nation without universal health care coverage? What is it about us? We're at 1-800-423-8255. My guest tonight from Atlanta, Georgia, David Satcher, former U.S. Surgeon General. From Gettysburg, Maryland, Joseph Antos, former Assistant Director for Health and Human Resources at the Congressional Budget Office and now a scholar in health care and retirement policy at the American Enterprise Institute. And with me in the studio, Marcia Angel, senior lecturer at Harvard Medical School and former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. Right now we have Kevin calling from Orleans, Massachusetts. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks very much. Yeah, I think there's no question that mobilizing public opinion is real important. And one thing I'd like to see is, remember they used to have a big billboard in Times Square where they had the national deficit and it was changed every second and
sure,
it was very dramatic?
Famously up there for many years.
Well, let's famously get one up there. How many people are not have no insurance and have subcategories? How many children? And how, you know, put it in people's faces and you could have ads on TV to you know, just have someone standing in front of that and say, look at this, or, you know, have them in every town.
But when Joseph Antos says, look, nobody's speaking up for this, it's not going to happen, this is la-la land, what do you think,
Kevin?
Well,
you know, there were 100 congressmen for single payer when Hillary had single payer off the table. She was not allowed to even discuss single payer, but there were 100 congressmen at the time who were for it.
So put up the billboard and remind Americans how many are uninsured at any given moment. We've got it.
Well, you could almost have a national referendum or a constitutional amendment. You have to go around the politicians because they are so afraid. So much money will be mobilized against them if they stand up for it. Al Gore in the last campaign said, we can't afford it, and that was about all he ever said about it.
And that was it. And one can only imagine the resources that would be marshaled to oppose the end of such a gigantic industry. But, Kevin, thanks for your call. Marcia Angel, compare this proposal for us, if you would, to the Clinton proposal that went down so ignominiously
a
decade ago. Is this the same thing or something else?
Not at all. The Clinton proposal was a hopelessly complicated proposal that tried to offer everything to everybody. And in particular, it wanted to keep a place at the table for the private insurance industry.
So it ultimately shrank from saying the end to all that is nigh.
That's exactly right. And the private insurance industry said, well, why should we just have a place at the table when we can have the whole thing?
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want half a loaf. They wanted the whole loaf. And so they pulled out Harry and Louise, and they pulled out a big campaign to scare the American people.
The TV campaign. I just can't understand this.
That's exactly right. And you can't blame them for not understanding it. It was hopelessly complicated in order to keep everybody happy.
So where is the political counterweight to the private health insurance industry today? Let's say JAMA comes out tomorrow in a firestorm. I mean, I don't know, but let's just say it becomes an issue in the presidential campaign. What's the opposing force that's really going to stand up and articulate this?
Well, let me start by saying that we're at a point now where we really have no option. The opponents like to say it's unrealistic, but in fact, anything else is unrealistic. Because if you keep the system the way it is now, and you say we're going to do this incrementally, you will inevitably, if you want to increase access, increase costs. But where's the money? The federal government has a huge deficit. The state governments are broke. So there's not going to be an extra penny put into it.
But for many years, we've just carried that limited access. Those 40 million or so are just...
That's right.
Well, maybe we just go on doing that.
Well, not with this economy, because as Kevin says, the numbers would go up very fast in Times Square.
Mm-hmm.
People are hurting, and not just poor people, but the middle class.
Mm.
Doctors are unhappy. It is a system that can't go on. So something has to happen. Mm. If you keep the system the same, and you try to increase access, you'll increase costs. If you try to control costs, you'll decrease access.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about it, that's sort of a no-brainer.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to change the system. And this is the only way that you could increase access and simultaneously control costs.
David Satcher,
so there's no other option.
David Satcher, I know we have to let you go in just a moment, but do you agree? Is the system as we know it, as we've known it, at the end of its road? Is it now somehow necessary that there be a radical change?
Well, I think it's critical that there be a radical change. I think our system is in deep trouble, and it's getting worse. The costs are going up, more and more people are uninsured. So I think we're at a point where we have to make a change, and certainly wisdom would say it's time for a change. You know, all of the indicators are there, and I think people just need a spark. And what I'm optimistic about is that they're going to see that spark. And I think things can change pretty rapidly when people see the spark to say, look, we can change this. We can do better than we're doing. We can cover everybody in this country, and we can do it by reducing administrative costs. So we're not increasing the cost, and yet we're covering people who have not been covered before. We're offering coverage for mental health, for dental health, long-term care, able to support prevention and public health more aggressively. I mean, the opportunities are just tremendous here, realistic.
And, you know, just hearing you describe that list, cradle to grave, dental, mental, long-term, physical health coverage, I mean, the amount of stress that would take out of many American families' lives would be enormous to know that those would simply be covered.
General, as you probably know, I released the first ever reports on mental health. And I have to tell you, the response that I received from the American people, all of the stories, the personal stories of families struggling with children with mental disorders, with parents, and the suffering that's going on in this country. And the question is, what does it take for people who are suffering together to stand up together and to say that, you know, we want to change this. Whatever you're going to say, we're not going to take it anymore. But there's a spark that's going to come, and I think it's going to be amazing how fast we're going to see people look for this option that we're describing today.
Well, it would indeed be amazing. David Satcher, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
David Satcher is director of the National Center for Primary Care at Morehouse School of Medicine and was U.S. Surgeon General from 1998 to 2002. Chuck is calling from Sherburne, Massachusetts. Hi, Chuck. You're on the air.
Yes, I have a couple of comments. First of all, in our state of Massachusetts, the recent study being done that was done at taxpayer money, about $250,000 by LECG, said that the administrative costs were 40%. And every study that I've seen is that it's above 30%. And for some reason or other, this job...
You're talking in the private health industry, private insurance.
The entire system, how much it costs.
Right.
Right,
the one that David Himmelstein is saying in Medicare is 3.5%. You're saying the private sector is. You're saying 40%.
Yes, because what happens is then you have to bring that all the way through the system. What does the physician have to do to process those forms? That's an administrative cost.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you what you're talking about is one huge swath where everything is eliminated. So if you're talking about just from the point of view of the whole system, it's 40%.
And what does that say to you, Chuck, that it could be changed?
That tells me that the savings could be even greater. Now, there's another factor in here that I think is really important that has been entirely overlooked at this point. The fraud in the present system is far greater than the 10% currently being officially quoted. And Sparrow from the Kennedy School has documented this, where you get fraud rates in some sectors up to, and I'm not kidding here, he has solid information, 90%. Now, one of the things about a single-payer system is that it would be one database of payments and would be far easier to detect fraud.
We'll take it right there, Chuck, and thanks for your call. Joseph Antos, our time is running down. David Satcher says there's enough pain out there that a spark could really set things on fire around this issue. Can you imagine it?
Yes, I can. Our current system is broken, or at least severely fractured. There's no question about it. I just don't think this is the approach that most Americans want to embrace. They tend to be conservative in their views, and they tend to be nervous about people making big changes. But there are things we can do. One of the biggest problems we have is, in fact, government policy. The government subsidizes through the tax system a vast amount of overspending in the private insurance system. We're giving huge subsidies to people who are very well off. In fact, all of the people on this phone call are getting very, very large subsidies, and low-income people are getting very, very small subsidies through the tax system. We could fix that. We should fix that.
Marsha Angel, our time's running down, but is there a halfway solution? Is there a compromise that, like the AMA says, well, let's keep elements of what we've got now? Does it really have to be all or nothing?
It does. Not without increasing costs, and we just shouldn't pour good money after bad in this system.
So this would mean the end of my private health care monthly payment, but I would pay higher taxes.
You would probably pay somewhat higher taxes, but it would be more than offset by what you would save in the out-of-pocket deductibles and co-payments and health insurance premiums.
Well, let's just see if a spark comes out of all this. Certainly there's enough uncovered Americans and enough pain out there that people ought to pay attention. Marsha Angel, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Marsha Angel is senior lecturer at Harvard Medical School. And Joseph Antos, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Joseph Antos is a scholar in health care and retirement policy at the American Enterprise Institute. You can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a gay student comes out against America's first gay high school. This is On Point. When New York City announced it will open the nation's first high school for gay and lesbian teens this fall, conservatives lined up to condemn the taxpayer-funded initiative. Criticism of the Harvey Milk School initiative has come now from many quarters, including from the family of the school's namesake. Harvey Milk's nephew told the New York Post yesterday that the slain civil rights leader would have opposed the idea of creating a separate school for gay students only. 22-year-old Leland Scrooby knows the perils of being a gay teenager. He came out while he was in high school in Pittsburgh. He, too, questions the logic behind the Harvey Milk School.
As a young gay man only a few years out of high school, I see the appeal of the Harvey Milk High School. But it is the easy way out, an exercise in wishful thinking that will do little to foster tolerance. I know that public high schools can be unfriendly and scary, especially if you are homosexual. But the purpose of high school is not just earning a diploma, but also learning how to interact with people who may be different from you. There's no way an isolated, segregated environment will teach homosexual and heterosexual students to coexist and respect each other. After years of keeping silent, I decided to come out during my sophomore year in high school. I knew it wouldn't be easy, but at least I would be facing reality. My school, Shenley High School in Pittsburgh, is an inner-city public school. It is slightly famous because Andy Warhol went there, and it's pretty liberal, but there was still the same bullying and homophobia that exist in just about every high school. At first, I only told a few people, but within a month, the whole school knew. Much to my surprise, my life got better. I made a new set of friends among other students who considered themselves outsiders. Teachers, impressed by my courage, gave me support. My grades improved significantly. By the end of my junior year, my grade point average went up to an A from a C. Sure, not every day was easy, but by lifting the burden of my secret, I was able to get my act together and start focusing on my future. I know that not every gay high school student has such a positive experience, but straight high school students don't have entirely positive experiences either. High school is difficult for everyone. My coming out was great for the school. Students who had never known a gay person now knew one, and I wasn't scary to them. I do think it's important for people to express their sexuality, even at a young age, and it's only fair that they should be able to do so in a safe environment. But if gay students are afraid of being called names, going to an exclusively gay high school is not going to solve their problems. The straight bullies and the closeted gay bullies will be able to thrive and fester in their own hateful paradise, while the gay students will sit around hating the bullies in theirs. The sad truth is that gay people are discriminated against no matter what, no matter where we go to school, where we live, or where we work. Segregating gay students won't prevent it. Rather than promoting unity and understanding, it will foster intolerance among both straight and gay people.
Leland Scrooby is a senior at Carnegie Mellon University. He hails from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT networks.